Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded January 24th, 2024. Well, Monday, Canada's military aided in the bombing of Yemen. The Department of National Defense says Canada and a coalition of like-minded nations support the Anglo-American bombing of the country. The CIA World Factbook says suffers, quote, massive poverty, food insecurity, unemployment, and high inflation. Yemen is also one of the poorest places on the planet and has been victim to a long-running regime change campaign sponsored by the same Anglo-American Axis powers now bombing it. All factors making it a sterling candidate for Canadian political and military meddling. According to my first guest, Canada has contributed to the undermining and overthrowing of more than 20 separate national governments since the middle of the last century, all of them in countries that dared declare political and economic sovereignty. Eve Angler is a Montreal-based political activist and the author of 12 books, mostly detailing the dark dealings of Canada's foreign policy elite. Make that 13 titles as of next week when Berica Books releases Eve's latest, co-authored with Olin Schalk, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. Eve is also a prolific essayist whose writing appears across the internet and at his website eveangler.com, where his most recent piece, When Leftists Use Anti-Semitism Smears to Weaken Palestinian Solidarity. Eve Angler in the first half. And on January 7th, Ecuadorian gang boss Adolfo Macias escaped from prison, embarrassing the recently elected tough-on-crime president Daniel Noboa. Since then, paramilitary raids and assassinations of public figures, one notably killed on live television, have ping-ponged, marking an escalation of violence that at first paralyzed and continues to terrorize the South American nation. Joe Emmonsberger is a Canadian, Ecuadorian engineer, journalist, and co-author with Justin Potter of the book Extraordinary Threat, the U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 Years of Coup Attempts in Venezuela. Joe's many articles focusing on Western media coverage of the Americas can be found at fair.org, Counterpunch, and Telesur English, among other places. Joe Emmonsberger and the chaotic descent of Latin America's once most peaceful nation in the second half. But first, Eve Angler and Canada's regime change cowboys high in the saddle over Yemen. Welcome back to the show, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, hey, and welcome back home. You recently returned from a stay in East Africa. Eve, did you get a sense while you were there of the public mood regarding the Gaza genocide and the actions, especially of Yemen's Ansar Allah, referred to in the media here, of course, as the Houthis?
Yeah, what I can say is that everyone I talk to, mostly with my partner's family, they obviously consider what Israel's doing as brutal and shocking, and I'm guessing that that is a pretty widely held opinion among Ugandans. I can also say that, but I didn't, you know, talk to many people on the street about it. But you can glean from reading the East African, which is a kind of like the Financial Times or Wall Street Journal of Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania, that. You know, even in this fairly elite paper, the commentary was all very clearly that, you know, Israel's committing genocide, and by Canadian standards, you know, they're publishing articles that are, you know, unacceptable in the, you know, liberal Toronto Star or on the CBC website. So clearly among elite opinion in Uganda, it's, you know, They see it as it actually is, not how it's reframed in our propaganda system.
Well, and Eve, congratulations on your new book. Now, this is number 13, if I'm counting correctly. I've run out of fingers, so correct me if I'm wrong. Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. When you talk about the acceptable views rebroadcast on the CBC about this issue or that issue, how much, Eve, is the media in this country responsible for this continued behavior of Canada, as you describe in your book, this fight against democracy?
The media is integral to the process. As I've made the point previously, you know, on international affairs, media's power is much greater than on domestic issues, because most people have when it comes to like the healthcare system or minimum wage, most people have some, you know, they maybe they work minimum wage, they have family members working minimum wage. So increasing the minimum wage, they understand the effects. And even if the media says it's going to, you know, lead to the end of business, or, you know, if they say that the healthcare system is all a disaster and this and that, if you have some personal interaction with the health system, you know, know, okay, yeah, there are problems, but, you know, I didn't have to pay to use it. But when it comes to international affairs, we have almost no, most people have very little kind of like personal grounding. So how the media frames the issues becomes so politically important. And on foreign policy issues in general, the media is deeply aligned with the government perspective, with the perspective of power. And, you know, concretely with regards to the book about Canada's role in 20 different coups over the past 70 years, you know, you can say it's like permissible in the dominant media to say that, you know, Canada has supported undemocratic governments, right? Like we've, you know, sold weapons to the dictatorship in Saudi Arabia. That's like a sort of permissible. But to say that Canada has repeatedly not just upheld, you know, anti-democratic governments or worked with anti-democratic governments, but overthrown elected governments because they were, you know, working against the interests of the U.S. empire and the corporate world. That's just absolutely unpermissible because Canada is a force for democracy. It's just like taken for granted. We just, you know, we don't even need to have that discussion. It's obvious that Canada is a force for democracy, even if any serious look at the historic record shows that that's not the case. You know, the left end of the dominant media, the CBC or Toronto Star, they simply will not allow, maybe, you know, once every year they have one op-ed that says that Canada has overthrown elected governments, but they, as any sort of consistent theme on international affairs, it's just impermissible to say Canada has consistently undermined democracy. And that's, you know, way at the far liberal end of the officialdom media.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Yves Engler. Yves, a Montreal-based political activist, and he's an author of a dozen books. But wait, not a dozen, 13 books. As of the end of this month, Baraka Books will release a book that Yves co-authored with Owen Schock, if you could correct my pronunciation on that, Yves. It's called Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. Yves, this isn't the first time that you've collaborated on a book. Can you tell me about your collaborator and firstly how to correctly pronounce his name, perhaps?
That's correct. And Owen is a young, impressive voice in challenging Canadian foreign policy. It's I don't know if people have seen, people could check out his writing on particularly on Canadian Dimension, but he has been the last couple of years published dozens and dozens of articles on a wide range of Canadian foreign policy topics that are really indispensable, and I think that I've said that I think that the fight around making for a just Canadian foreign policy, unfortunately, it's not going to happen overnight, and it's going to take decades and decades of struggle, mostly, but also at the ideological level of consciousness raising. And Owen has been a really important contributor to that, to breaking down the mythology in recent years. It was very nice process of collaborating with him to publish this. This history of Canada's role in foreign coups.
Of course, the Gaza thing, the Gaza genocide goes on. And Yves, I had something here. You were talking on your program, and you can reiterate your Monday show for everybody, but I just came in kind of late and caught in the rerun. You were saying that you were blocked entrance into the United States recently. And if I get this right, you think that it might have something to do with your criticism of America's role in Gaza. Am I getting this right?
Well, the first part, yes. To go to Uganda, we were set to fly through New York, and we had a 20-hour layover where the plan was for our six-year-old son to go down to see, you know, Times Square, and a short little trip. But I was blocked at the U.S. Border agents who happened to have a piece of the Montreal airport. So I wasn't even allowed to get on the plane. I don't know why. The official reason for stopping me was something to do with in 2007. And in my understanding, I have to check out these details, but they're claiming that I was convicted of a crime in 2007, which would be obviously a political crime. I don't actually understand that to be true. Maybe my memory has gotten me got so confused, but I'm pretty sure it's not correct. But I've been to the U.S. since 2007 multiple times. I have had difficulty one other time that I was ultimately let in 2010. But I've been probably seven or eight times, I think, over the past 17 years. My guess for why they have targeted me was to do with the fact that we disrupted Secretary of State Blinken and Melanie Jolie about a year and a bit ago at the Jean Talon market. Very successful. They came out to a kind of public area and a handful of us yelled, mostly around Haiti, and they had to actually scuttle away very quickly. It was quite a successful, widely reported on. And also about a year and a half ago, the U.S. ambassador was trying to speak. I spoke here in Montreal, and I tried to enter the room, and I was going to, you know, say bad things about the U.S. empire, and I was detained and arrested for that. Ultimately, I agreed to this sort of condition to have the whole thing kind of gotten rid of, which, as I understood, was all dealt with. The condition has ended. And it's possible it's just more general that I've, you know, been engaged politically a lot in the last couple of years, and that sort of got onto the U.S. government's radar. But my guess is it has to do with either the Secretary Blinken's visit to Montreal or the U.S. ambassador incident. And of course, that was quite unpleasant to be blocked from. I had to get a whole new ticket, and it was kind of a mess. But, you know, the U.S. empire, they struck back against my questioning of U.S. Canadian imperialism.
Well, it brings back the whole no-fly list era and stuff. And I guess that never really went away. People just stopped talking about it. Yeah, well, you and I have talked about your work with the Disruption Network. Do you want to briefly describe what Disruption Network is, especially in the context of all those that are coming out week in and week out? I know they've been doing it in Montreal. They've been doing it, or we've been doing it here in Victoria too. But every week, the first week after October 7th, people have been manifesting at the legislature in Victoria's case, but in Montreal too, in demonstrating against the ongoing Gaza genocide. People that are maybe fed up and thinking, well, geez, you know, it's great. We go out there and stand around, but what does it accomplish? Well, there's other tactics too, and Disruption Network is one of them. Do you want to describe what it is?
Yeah, well, so Disruption Network Canada, which was a sort of formalized alliance or information sharing network, kind of got squashed by the pandemic. We had kind of individuals across the country, you know, sharing information about upcoming meetings by ministers and going there and asking tough questions, or in some cases kind of more actively disrupting events. Now, that kind of political tactic, we've seen a whole lot of that, and quite successfully in recent months with the popular uprising against Canada's role in Israel's enabling Israel's genocide. Probably the best example of that, where people in in Vancouver maybe 6 weeks, 2 months ago, where they figured out where Trudeau was at a restaurant, and they got very good. They got right next to Trudeau with very good video image of demanding he call for a ceasefire. And he was forced out of the restaurant, and then they followed up with another one at another restaurant that he moved to later on in the evening. And there's been a whole bunch of those examples of it's kind of melding the sort of technology of the day, in that we all have access to camera, or most of us have access to cameras on our phones, and there's the social media. So you can ask tough questions of politicians, or interrupt a meeting, film it yourself, post it on X, on Facebook, on other social media. And often it gets very wide circulation of social media. Also, in the case of the Vancouver disruption I was talking about 2 months ago, that was, I think that ended up being the top item on the CBC, the National. I saw it on the National. So it even gets picked up by the corporate media, by the dominant media. And I think there's for foreign policy issues, for issues where the media, there's just so little room for critical discussion, this type of tactic becomes very important, because it is a way, in some cases, it's a way, if you go to a press conference and you disrupt on a foreign policy issue, you can get the corporate media to report on it, because they are there. And so you sort of take advantage of the power the government has, the ministers have, to convene the media, the dominant media. And then you just go there and you sort of steal a little bit of their thunder. You steal a little bit of the messaging by going and raising a different issue. Oftentimes, even when you do that, the corporate media won't even report on it. But that's where the social media side comes into it, where you can film yourself doing it, and you can have it circulated widely on social media. So it's complementary to mass protests, to the direct actions that have been taking place in terms of shutting down. I think people have all kinds of things, shutting down bridges and train lines and different meetings. But I think the tactic of often done at an individual level, or two or three people just going to these meetings, press conferences, events, and either just doing it in a questioning format, which often can be in fact the most successful, because these what you find is that these ministers don't ever get asked. The journalists and the officialdom that go to their that have access to these politicians, they never ask the really simple questions that you say that Russian and Belarusian athletes should be banned from all international sporting competitions like the Olympics, but do you feel the same way about U.S. troops or U.S. athletes after the U.S. invasion? That's one of the ones I asked Canada's sports minister, and she literally looked at me and sort of scoffed, like this was the craziest question in the world, even though it was actually a totally reasonable question. But they never get asked these questions. And so you can do that kind of at an individual level and really kind of embarrass them. And sometimes, like millions of people watch these things on social media, and, very small pushback to the stifling discourse in the dominant media.
Well, yeah. Well, we've seen with disruption, Code Pink has done it in the States with great effect. And Tamara Lawrence of Canadian Voice of Women for Peace here in Canada has done a number of these interventions as well. Well, and the government was in your neck of the woods just yesterday in Montreal, taking a retreat. I guess they had spa treatment and stuff as well at this swanky hotel downtown. And they were welcome there as well, I understand. Were you there?
Yeah, I was there, and I can tell you this was the fortress, Queen Elizabeth. The policing around the hotel was absolutely stunning. I went down after dropping my son off to school at 8 a.m. I went down immediately to the hotel, and I was kind of just it's all connected into the Montreal train station, and it's connected into a mall. And I was hanging out at the mall, kind of hoping that I might, you know, Christopher Friedland might go get a coffee, or, you know, some Trudeau might go wandering about. And I was literally just sitting in this cafe area, not in the hotel, but close to the hotel, not in it. And I had these two undercovers just sit and watch me for probably 30 minutes. And I finally went up to them. I went up to him and asked him if he was an RCMP agent. I think in hindsight, he probably wasn't RCMP. I think he was actually Montreal police. But it was just a stunning level of police overreach. And obviously they would claim it was about, stopping some sort of terrorist attack or whatnot. But they know full well my danger is putting a video camera in the face of the prime minister or foreign minister and asking a tough question.
How did they ID you? Were you carrying a placard or something?
I wasn't carrying a placard, but they all recognized me. Unfortunately, at this point, they all recognized me. I literally, when I arrived around the side of the hotel, this Montreal police officer, as I walked around the corner, I saw him speaking. Heard him speaking to his microphone. Il est ici. He's here. They literally had when I went wandering around, when we had two protests in front of the hotel, and when I went wandering around to the other side, Montreal police officers on bikes literally followed me. Biked over, and then when I went back to the other side, they biked over the other side. And the first time they did it, I saw them, and they saw me. I just started laughing, and they started laughing because I think they even think it's kind of a joke. But they're, when you send hundreds of cops to a hotel, and there's nothing to do, that's what they do, is they just basically intimidate people who they know full well that at worst are going to maybe, yell at the politician. I've seen this before. Obviously, we saw that the G20 protests in Toronto. Mm-hmm. I saw some of that. I've seen it at other kind of things. It's part of this, the law. I think the logic of policing is that I had this whole discussion with the police officer. And he was like, well, it just, because, if I'm following you, it's no big deal. I had to be here anyways. Cause I was saying, well, this is a, huge waste of resources to be following me like this. And he's like, well, I had to be here anyways. And I was like, no, you don't, you don't have to be here. That's a political decision where you're deciding to spend a lot of money on sending hundreds of police officers around this hotel rather than putting those resources into, a school lunch program, right? These are political decisions. And an unfortunate, there's lots of freedom in our society in different ways, but there is also a quite remarkably repressive element. And actually, just one of the things I did do at the kind of milled about the outside the hotel in the mall that's connected to the hotel, and I had the opportunity to bump into David Cochrane, the CBC Power and Politics host. And I started asking him about why, he has a double standard on his treatment with regards to Israel's, they always say Hamas's massacre on October 7th, but they never use the same language around what the genocide Israel's committing. And this reporter, journalist, how he got away from it was to walk back into the fortress liberal cabinet retreat, and literally police physically blocked me from continuing to ask him questions. This is the antithesis of what a functioning democratic structure should be. Obviously, you should be able to ask journalists questions, or for that matter, politicians. But this is where the logic of security goes in the current, state of things.
God, that reminds me of meeting Sasha Petrovich years ago at a college media conference. in the elevator and saying and asking him about the recent, what was then recent, was the interception of Terry something Chuck, I've forgotten his name now. They had intercepted his emails between protesters in Vancouver at the Asia Pacific meetings, you know, APEC, way back when. And I asked him, well, did he think that they should be doing that? And he says, oh, it serves him right for, you know, talking on his email. This was a reporter saying that it was okay for one of his colleagues to have his messages between he and his sources intercepted. And he was taken to the carpet by the CBC for his comments with these protesters. Anyway, I don't know if you remember the case back in 2000-ish. 2001.
I don't, but what I think is the troubling element is that the level of like trust and close relations between media officials and both government officials and intelligence agencies. That's I think the and in this case of this Cochrane and how he, you know, I wasn't allowed into this hotel. He was allowed in. He had the special badge that got to the other side of the police line. I thought that was illustrative of how the official journalists and the official politician power structure are, you know, they have equal rights. They're you know, part of the same team that gets you know, protected by the police.
Big media is what they call it. Well, we're fast out of time, we're over time. Eve, I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you're doing other interviews. Again, you know, the book is Canada's long fight against democracy, and there's myriad ways, sanctions, financing opposition parties, using the Canadian embassy in countries as hideouts for people that are coosters that are going to violently overthrow a government as they did in Ukraine. Secret cabals and military interventions. How, Eve, do people get their hands on Canada's long fight against democracy, your book with Owen Schalk?
You can pre-order it through Baraka Books. And that's the best way. I think eventually it will hopefully be. And this is always really helpful from a personal standpoint. As many public libraries that can order it, the best from a personal standpoint and political standpoint for that matter. So anyone out there listening, please order it via your public libraries, because it's both gets it out to more people, and also there's a whole payment structure for authors that is based partly on how many libraries have the book, but yeah, you can order it from barakabooks.com. Obviously you can also order it through other, you know, corporate book purchasing places, but the best way is via Baraka Books. And also I hope to I will be out on a tour probably later in March.
Yeah, well, we'll see you out here, hopefully, in Victoria. And again, it's barakabooks.com. Support Canadian publishing imprints, and talk to your librarian and say, hey, do you have that book by that great Canadian author? What was his name? Eve Angler? And say, why not? And get him to order books in. I know our department here is tired of listening to me already at my local library. But thanks a lot again for coming on the show, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
And I want everyone else to stay tuned, because I'm going to be talking with Joe Emmonsberger about what's going on in his familial native Ecuador. It's a mess down there right now from the most what was once lauded as the most peaceful country in Central America, now to open civic warfare going on between gangs and the police and the corruption, everything else. Stay tuned for that. Thanks again, Eve.
Thanks.
Are you listening?
We've seen the world shrink, and now you can hear it too. Guerrilla Radio, a new century of news every week at guerrilla-radio.com.
Congress and the Bundestag, you'll see them wring their hands and say how they wish in hindsight they had tried to understand, how they wish they'd seen the warning signs and heard the generals speak and believed them when they talked about the vengeance they would wreak, how they should have known this was not idle conversation, how they should have listened harder when they said elimination. Yes, once it's all too late and the graveyards are all filled, once the last Palestinians killed. On Manhattan Island, in the halls of the UN, the whole world will come together to say never again. They'll open a museum full of relics of the past before those who used to live there resisted to the last. We'll look at pictures of the rubble with the dead limbs poking through. The viewers will shed a tear and wish the leaders knew before the war ended in the way Ben-Gavir had willed, once the last Palestinians killed. In the parliament they'll say, perhaps we should have listened instead of purging Europe's biggest party of internal opposition, should have paid attention to the millions in the streets, to those massive crowds around the globe voting with their feet. Should have read the signs, should have listened to their words instead of denouncing all the talk of genocide is just absurd. Should have looked at the pictures of the bodies charred and grilled, once the last Palestinians killed. When that last tower block was flattened, in the days before the last bakery was bombed, in this total war, when there were still kindergartens, when the hospital still stood, this would have been the time to question if we should have been sending all those weapons instead of barring them complete. If instead of cheering on the evil enemy's defeat, we might have asked if there was anywhere left for flour to be milled, once the last Palestinians killed. When the project is complete and they make the desert bloom, once they finish turning cities into tombs, once the dead are out of sight and buried in the ground, once the rubble has been bulldozed and no one hears the sound of dying children screaming from somewhere down below, once the shopping malls are gleaming and no one needs to know how many babies' bodies are in this soil that we've tilled, once the last Palestinians killed. Once the last Palestinians killed. Once the last Palestinians killed.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, on January 7th, Ecuadorian gang boss Adolfo Macias escaped from prison, embarrassing the recently elected tough-on-crime president Daniel Noboa. Since then, paramilitary raids and assassinations of public figures, one notably killed on live television, have ping-ponged, marking an escalation of violence that at first paralyzed and continues to terrorize the South American nation. Joe Emmonsberger is a Canadian-Ecuadorian engineer, journalist, and co-author with Justin Potter of the book Extraordinary Threat, the U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 Years of Coup Attempts in Venezuela. Joe's many articles focusing on Western media coverage of the Americas can be found at fair.org, Counterpunch, and Telesur English, among other places. Welcome back to the program, Joe.
Yeah, great. Thanks for inviting me, Chris.
It's always my pleasure. Now, Joe, we last talked in August during the violent run-up to Ecuador's presidential election, and where there were assassinations of political figures, right, left, and center, it seemed at the time. Joe, did that the violence then and the political assassinations that occurred then contribute to the bloody state of things that we're seeing now?
Well, this has been developing right since the Correa left office, and his successor, who actually won the election that year as a Correa loyalist, he did a very remarkable and cynical U-turn very quickly within weeks of taking office, and basically became a right winger. Just like, I mean, when Lasso won in 2021, it was really like he was winning a second term. because Moreno went full speed ahead to criminalize the Correa's movement, to basically do the opposite of what he did in every aspect, economically, in foreign policy, everything. And one of the fateful things is that he undid Correa's very successful, and I must stress, very successful crime reduction policies during his 10 years in office. So, you know, Ecuador, for a lot of reasons, from 1980 all the way through till 2011, you saw that we see that Ecuador's homicide rate was constantly increasing. It steadily increased from like probably around six or so homicide deaths per 100,000 in 1980 till about 18 or so by 2011, the first few years of Correa's time in office. But by the time Correa left office, the homicide rate had fallen to 5.8 per 100,000 deaths. That's in 2017. So it reduced by two thirds, and just a total reversal of the long-term trend that had been going on in Ecuador. And that's ever since he left office and Moreno did this U-turn, it's just gone back up again. And now it's over 46 deaths per 100,000 people. It is the highest it's ever been, perhaps ever, certainly in terms of the past 80 or so years where there's even statistics that are all reliable on that kind of thing.
Well, is the nature of the violence now, Joe, is this mostly gang violence
there is organized crime. This is driven largely by Ecuador, because of its, like I said, this is a long-term problem. This was a problem that was growing before Correa for decades. Ecuador's proximity to Colombia, which is the major, as everyone knows, drug cocaine producer. And so that proximity to Colombia has been bad for, I'd say it's been bad for really all of Latin America, not just Ecuador, but especially the closer you are, it just stands to reason that it's going to be more of a concern. And it takes a government that, like Correa's, that had a real belief in the state being powerful and the state being efficient and serving people. But the neoliberal idea, the capitalist idea, is basically the opposite, that the state should be basically just there to protect rich people and nobody else. And that's basically the constant weakening of the state that took place from 1980 till Correa's time in office. And then afterwards, when Moreno did this reversal, same idea, you weaken the state. And when you weaken the state, you have like an analyst I talked to recently from Ecuador, David Villamar, he told me when you weaken the state, you have these parallel structures of power that fill the vacuum. And in Ecuador, that's what's happened with a lot of organized crime, drug lords, what have you, taking over the prisons, taking over the ports, just having a free for all, just doing what they want. And it's exploded into such obvious humiliating scenes for Ecuador's elite at this point, where you see drug gangs taking over a TV station and stuff. It's obvious that they're running the prisons, they're assassinating people, they're just running wild because there's no state that's been willing to confront them. Just to give you an idea of how horrible it's been, I mean, Noboa, the new president, is trying to show that he's at least willing to confront. Now it's gotten to such a point where he really has no choice but to call out the army and try to take on the violent gangs directly. They're just all over the place, and they're making life hell for everybody. So he's been forced to call. I think any government of any ideological persuasion would have to do what Noboa did initially, is to try to get just confront them with armed force and try to get some semblance of control. I mean, one straightforward measure that he's been doing, that he's been getting some praise for, is that they cut the internet cables to some of the prisons to leave the criminals inside without internet. But if you think about that, why would these out of control prisons, why wouldn't that measure have been done years ago? You know, and the answer is that they've managed, the organized crime elements have managed to infiltrate all kinds of institutions, and it has to reach this unbearable point before the government's forced to just do the most basic stuff to try to get things under control.
Yeah, well, I mentioned off the top that there was an assassination on a live television show where these guys just stormed into the TV station, shot somebody dead. The guy that was in charge of the investigation of that, Cesar Juarez, himself was assassinated a week ago while he was just sitting in his car in traffic. They just walked him and killed him as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, the assassination, that's, there's been all kinds of assassinations of lower level political people, non-political people. Everyone's been touched by it. But the assassination that had the most electoral impact was the assassination of the very anti-Korea politician, Fernando Villavicencio. He's a former journalist, very sleazy, very unscrupulous character, right-wing character. But he was assassinated, and the Lasso's government at the time and the president, attorney general, she's been the attorney general since 2019. She's basically presided over the whole disaster. And they did everything they could to insinuate that it was Korea or Koreaists who were involved. And only now it started. Now everyone's pretty much common knowledge that he was. The story has not been totally fleshed out completely, but it looks like the most likely thing is that he was killed by drug lords who he was probably trying to intimidate to say, hey, I'm gonna if you don't give me money, I'll get you bad press. Because Fernando, since Correa left, he's one of these guys who's had the power to basically give people bad press if they don't do what is expected of them. And it looks like I can't prove this, but it looks like everything points like that, something like that happened where he was trying to extort dangerous people and they decided, you know what, we're just gonna bump you off. So it was something like that. But the cynical thing, the incredible thing, was that now everyone pretty much admits it was some kind of drug related, some kind of a crime like that, of that nature. Whereas, but when it happened shortly before the election, that there was a disconcerted effort to try to pin it on Correa and on Correa's people.
Yeah, and that was the Correista, Luisa Gonzalez.
Yeah, she was the candidate. Yeah,
and she's the candidate.
Correa is in Belgium with political asylum. He can't return. I mean, the political persecution over the past several years has been very extreme, and it's related to the crime problem, because you have a judicial system that's very corrupt, where it's all just about persecuting the Correaists and basically neglecting everything else and weakening the state. So it's all tied together. This whole disaster. It all stems from basically becoming a right-wing government that's only preoccupied with protecting the rich, criminalizing any opponent they see as dangerous to them, and that nothing else matters to them but that. And they've let this violent crime problem just blow up. And now Noboa, even though he's also a right winger, despite some of his rhetoric, he's being forced to at least do something to try to contain the situation.
Well, the Financial Times has a pretty extensive interview inside the Ecuadorian port city fighting a drug driven crime wave, and it's talking about the cartels that have moved into the drug trade. They've got just talking about the murder rate. They've got a graph here that shows Ecuador's murder rate is almost double of those in Mexico and Colombia. But Mexico plays a big part in what's going on there right now with the Sinaloa cartel moving into Ecuador in a big way. What do you know about that, Joe?
Well, the specifics are hard to keep track of. There's a whirlwind of information, and the thing that people have to take away is, look what happened during Correa's government. Why was there this two-thirds reduction in the homicide rate? I mean, I can tell you myself, I traveled all over Ecuador with my family on the highways, all over the place. First of all, the highways were dramatically improved, but we had nobody in my family had any fear of being assaulted or anything. It was very safe, and I can remember, because I traveled Ecuador frequently, that years earlier that was not the case. When during the 90s, early 2000s, everyone was very worried about getting mugged, about getting you were very careful. And the only time I remember feeling that my family was safe, it was when I was a young man visiting my family in the early 80s. Because, you know, what's happened since then, I think David Villamar explained to me when I talked to him recently, is that, you know, basically, like you mentioned, these gang, these cartels internationally, over time, they just have a lot more money. They're a bigger business, and their business is now booming to a far greater extent than it ever did during the 80s. So that gives them, if there's a vacuum, if there's a place that's weak, that allow them to have their, you know, get their way, then they'll move there and they'll operate there. And that's why, I mean, when Correa was in office, I mean, Correa took office first in 2007. By then, this drug business was, you know, very well developed. But he was able to wrestle it to the ground and keep Ecuadorians safe, because you needed a much expanded government. He had three of the ministries he had, or at least two or three of the ministries he created for security, have been eliminated by under Moreno. They have this belief that you chop the state down, like kind of like Milei is doing in Argentina. This psychotic thing. You know, we got to weaken the state. You have to bring the state down to its bare essentials, so that all it does is basically just protect rich people. But in Latin America, it's such a toxic variety. It doesn't even protect rich people. Ultimately, it becomes such a free for all and so dangerous that even people with money are afflicted by this.
Oh, heaven forbid. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Joe Amesberger. He's a Canadian Ecuadorian engineer journalist. He's the co-author with Justin Potter of the book Extraordinary Threat: The U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 Years of Coup Attempts in Venezuela. His articles are published at fair.org, Counterpunch, and Telesur, among other places. We're talking today about Ecuador and the current crime situation. This looks like chaos. It looks like mayhem. When you talk about Correa having maybe an easier time in 2007 taming the gangs and the gang violence, today it seems out of control, except for in places like El Salvador. I talked last week about that, Joe, and about the leader there, Bukele's so-called state of exception. Do you know what that refers to?
I haven't followed Bukele much, so I don't want to comment too much. But there has been a reduction in violent crime in El Salvador, but I don't know what the trade-offs have been in terms of human rights abuses and stuff like that. You have to bear in mind what Correa achieved in Ecuador. Not only did he achieve this two-thirds reduction in the homicide rate, you know, which was unprecedented in its decades, but he achieved it without mass incarceration, without the death penalty, without extraditing people, extraditing Ecuadorians to the U.S. or stuff like that. So by expelling the U.S. base from Manta, the U.S. had a military base in Ecuador that Correa got rid of by 2009, and that's one of the things they say. Oh, he got rid of the base that caused a violent crime. As if people, yeah, it's really a dumb argument. The violent crime collapsed after they got rid of the base in Ecuador, and also, of course, Colombia has all kinds of U.S. military presence, and they've been plagued with tremendous crime, insurgency, everything else. So, yeah, so I don't want to comment too much on Bukele, but I just want to point out that Correa's policies were effective. I mean, they definitely involved using police. But he also filtered out corruption in the police. He had the police to be police, you had to take polygraph tests. You had to have extensive background checks and stuff that he introduced that was unprecedented. All that's been dismantled. All that's been dismantled since he left office. So it's been a free for all. It's just been just a great environment for these very wealthy organized crime groups to start infiltrating and start getting their way.
Well, according to my guests last week, the state of exception is the exception to the Constitution and the rules of democracy as we understand them in the West for that country, specifically to fight these gangs. And yeah, the costs have been very high in human rights, and all those things you mentioned, of course, have come into play, and thousands, tens of thousands of perfectly innocent El Salvadorians have been arrested and put in these mega max prisons that have been built, as well as political opponents, union organizers, and the kinds of things that you would expect. The reason I mention it, though, Joe, is because other countries in the region are looking to El Salvador now and saying, oh, well, maybe we should be doing that. Is there any talk of, similar to that in Ecuador right now coming out of the government?
Of course, yes. I mean, they'll always look for some kind of so-called, which is really, really infuriating, because they had an incredibly successful approach that worked wonders for 10 years and that did not involve mass incarceration, did not involve all these human rights abuses, did not involve the death penalty or police running around shooting people. It just involved very smart, basically cleaning up the judicial system. It involved the judiciary too. It involved reform to the judiciary. And he got, you know, these groups that are now like Human Rights Watch is disgusting. They're telling the, for example, they're issuing statements to Nabo, oh, be careful with the state of exception, which is, I mean, it, on its surface is valid, but Human Rights Watch was a really belligerent critic of Correa's government. And they were praising Moreno and for all the horrible things he did, basically for creating, they were praising him for creating the catastrophe that, that Ecuador is now living through. So, yeah, I mean, of course, the right wing likes to point to a so-called successful model from a right-wing country, but also they'll distort and lie about and ignore as much as possible the successful model that they had in Ecuador under a left-wing government.
Well, yeah, and the idea that the prisons too now have been are basically owned by the gangs, that members of opposing gangs are being murdered.
A basic thing like splitting up the gangs is something that they haven't been willing to do. They've actually put the gangs together. You know, you want them together. I mean, just the most basic things, the most basic controls of just because of corruption. And again, and linked to that, the ideology of just weakening the state, giving the state fewer resources. It all links together. And also the judiciary and the whole legal system preoccupied with political persecution rather than prioritizing, you know, defending their people.
What have the Americans had to say about this? I know they get their noses into everybody's business in their backyard.
It's been an excuse. Like you say, it's been an excuse now where Ecuador is signing agreements with probably unconstitutional agreements that they've just recently signed for security cooperation with the United States. Well, it'll be it'll be a bonanza for the, it has been already for years, but it's going to be with under the cover of helping Ecuador fight crime. They're already situating themselves as if they were as if Ecuador were once again a colony of the United States. They've recently, like I said, the Constitutional Court, which was fired and replaced under Moreno to make sure it was right wing enough. They've been approving all these deals that Noboa even recently made with the United States. So that they get their noses in basically overseeing Ecuador's legal system.
Yeah. Well, and again, to the point of the Americans saying that, or people in Ecuador saying when an American base was removed, this would increase gang activity, where we know in Colombia being the perfect example that wherever the American influence is, the drug business goes up, not down.
Well, look at El Salvador. I mean, what was the United States doing in El Salvador for decades? I mean, where did the gang problem come from? It came from a civil war fueled by the United States trying to prop up a fascist dictatorship, you know. And then you had when you had demobilization happen, right? You had a lot of people with guns, you know, basically direct their attention to crime, you know, because they had death squads before, right? So if you look closely. Any country in Latin America, you can see what a toxic influence the United States has had constantly throughout the last few centuries.
Yeah, and the dirty wars in the 80s were especially brutal, and it created there's been now the gang situation in El Salvador created a massive emigration. Is there been any sense of that? I know Ecuador is much further away from America, but has there been an exodus from the country of this?
Yes, because of this and because of the horrible. There's been a 13-point increase in poverty. The poverty rate's increased dramatically, especially with COVID. Ecuador had a horrific COVID response. And with all lousy economic policies over the last 7 years, their poverty rate has increased, and insecurity, it's all fueled. There's been like a second major wave of migration. There's this place called the Darien Strait. That's where people from South America cross into Central America, migrants, and Ecuador is second, I think, to Venezuela in terms of number of people crossing that area. Because in Ecuador, you have to bear in mind, it's not only further away from the States, but has half the population as Venezuela. So when their migration numbers are comparable, that tells you how bad it is.
Well, so what, Joe, we're fast running out of time. What prescriptions are or is the government offering right now? Then they've brought out the military. Is that it?
You know, aside from bringing out the military, they're gonna go for right wing type, like kind of a Bukele type approach, right? They're gonna want to clamp down on human rights. Basically, they're gonna want to extradite Ecuadorians. That's another thing that the right's been trying to do. They failed to do under Lasso. They tried to do it now. They'll try to get a referendum, maybe question to get to see if they can legalize extraditing people to the United States. So stuff like that. It'll be basically try to legitimize a right wing approach and anything but the approach that actually worked for 10 years and had you know fantastic results.
Well, it looks like the new president is in for a short trip, but a bumpy one. Well, yeah. Well, Joe, before we go, there was since we last talked, and actually quite recently, I mean, we have talked in the past about Alex Saab. He's been released. Do you want to briefly remind listeners who Alex Saab is and the status of his liberty right now?
Yeah, Alex Saab was actually absolutely horrendous. I wrote about it for fair.org a few years ago. He was arrested despite being a special envoy, a diplomat for the Venezuela, which should have granted him immunity. He was traveling to Iran to make deals to help Venezuela bypass economic sanctions, which are devastating to the population. So he was trying to help them working as a diplomat, and he was illegally arrested in Cape Verde. Off the coast of South Africa, basically, and illegally arrested, and then ultimately they have an extradition. It was all illegal from start to finish. You can get into the legal technicalities, but it was just an abomination from every legal angle you can think of. And he was ultimately imprisoned in the United States. And what they finally worked out, because of all the problems the United States has, its foreign policy really under stress all over the world because of its own belligerence. So now it worked out a deal with Maduro where he released a bunch of basically U.S. citizens who have been involved in coups and whatnot, and he released them in exchange for Alex Saab and got him back to the Venezuela. It was a big victory for anyone who cares about human rights and human decency. It was a big victory, fortunately, Alex Saab is now back with his family.
Well, that's good. And he was also a cancer survivor and sufferer still, as far as I understand.
Yes.
Yeah. And Lenin Moreno, too, damnable because of his turning over Julian Assange to the American authorities. And Julian Assange just next month will be facing his final opportunity to defy American extradition in a British court. And I'll probably be doing something about that. Right. Joe, thanks a lot for coming back on the show again. It's always interesting to get a view of other part of the world that we don't usually get much information about up here.
Well, thanks very much for having me on. Thanks, appreciate it.
All right, until the next time, and thanks to Eve Engler for coming on. That's all I got for this week. Until the next time, thanks, Joe.
See you, Chris. Bye-bye.
When that last tower block was flattened, in the days before the last bakery was bombed, in this total war when there were still kindergartens, when the hospital still stood, this would have been the time to question if we should have been sending all those weapons instead of barring them complete. If instead of cheering on the evil enemy's defeat, we might have asked if there was anywhere left for flour to be milled once the last Palestinians killed. When the project is complete and they make the desert bloom, once they finish turning cities into tombs, once the dead are out of sight, and buried in the ground. Once the rubble has been bulldozed and no one hears the sound of dying children screaming from somewhere down below. Once the shopping malls are gleaming and no one needs to know how many babies' bodies are in this soil that we've tilled. Once the last Palestinians killed. Once the last Palestinians killed.